morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lorac. Coming up today, we're going to hear an interview with a representative of a group that has former members of hate groups in it. We're going to look back at the January 6th invasion of the U.S. Capitol from the perspective of people that formerly were neo-Nazis and members of the Ku Klux Klan. We're also going to try to raise some money here, and we're going to hear the end of Democracy Now! Too. So we got a lot going on here as we go into the last day of fundraising here at WMNF for this mini drive. And Duncan Strauss is back. He had a really good show. Hey, Duncan.
Are you hearing me? Sorry. Okay, cool. Yeah, so we had kind of a nice flourish towards the end, so I just want to thank a few folks if it's okay, including Stephanie Miller from Land O'Lakes with a nice $50 pledge and taking the dog CD, and so that's that. Steve Shaw from Land O'Lakes with a $200 pledge and says, this is in memory of my wife Myra. Music brought us together, and no one does it better than WMNF. Colleen McGar from Jupiter, actually by way of a cat named Eclipse, made a nice donation as well. And Mikkel Moorhead from St. Petersburg joined the Circle of Friends. Sorry we don't have the audio clip for that, but getting a couple of lily brushes to get pet hair off their stuff. Robert from Thonatassa with joining Circle of Friends. And and then Anonymous from Newport Richey with a nice $200 pledge. And Trish Laxo from St. Petersburg, $70 pledge. Thank you for everything you do, music, talk shows, and all talking. She's taking two of the pet hair removal brushes. Anonymous from Prospect, Kentucky. So that's a nice, huge anonymous pledge. And then Vicky from, I'm not sure where, but with a nice joining the Circle of Friends at $10 a month. And at the sort of final stretch here, someone took Deborah Lansdowne from St. Pete, took the condo week.
Right.
So thank you for that, and we'll get you all squared away. So I'm not sure where we ended up in our total, but it was a nice last-minute flurry.
Yeah, sounds like you went way over your goal. That's congratulations.
Great. Well, thanks.
Yeah,
that's
great.
Maybe we'll have a report when we get that tally, but thanks, Rob.
All right.
Thanks, Sean. Yeah. Back to you.
Guys. Okay. Well, thanks, Duncan Strauss and Talking Animals. They did really good. Mm-hmm. They went well over their goal. Terrific turnout for Talking Animals. And if you enjoy listening to all the public affairs, we hope that sometime in this 4 hours between 9 a.m. and 1 p.m. that you'll make a contribution. We've got a huge goal today. We've got to raise about $14,000. Giant, giant goal. And Sean Cannan is here. I'm Rob Lorai. We are going to hear from the group Life After Hate, which is going to give us their perspective on the January 6th incursion into the U.S. Capitol. That's coming up this hour. We're also going to hear the answer to the question that Juan Gonzalez posed to the member of the Sunrise Movement about climate change, and the senator from West Virginia, Joe Manchin. We've got a bunch of people to thank, though. Sean, why don't you take it away? Why don't you thank all those people that have called in the last since we last talked to them?
Yeah, these are some people who have donated. A $120 contribution from Cynthia in Seminole Heights. She listens daily from 6 in the morning until 4 in the afternoon. The News and Public Affairs and Democracy Now! Are invaluable resources, she says, so thank you for that donation. Also, Anonymous contributed $120, and that's coming all the way from Spring Hill, thank you. And Joe and Lori Call from Tarpon Springs have contributed $25. They say they're already a Circle of Friends member, but they really appreciate Democracy Now! And everything that Rob Lorai does, it keeps us informed. Daryl Purchase, $20 contribution from St. Pete, and Stephen Ellie from Dunedin is contributing $200, likes Democracy Now! So thank you to everyone who's donated so far. We still need to hear from you, 813-238-8001.
And you're listening to us, a wide range of people from a wide range of communities here in the Tampa Bay area who all are voluntarily supporting WMNF. And here's somebody from Brunswick, Maine, who just made a $60 contribution. They say they're a new contributor. They like the news and the 60s show the best.
Thank you,
Anonymous.
Thank you.
Bo in St. Pete just made a $14 contribution. Thanks, Bo. And thanks to Anonymous in Newport Richey, a $26 donation. Thank you. And Jennifer, thank you. Thank You in Sarasota, $30 contribution. By the way, sometimes we read people's full names with their okay. Sometimes we read people's first name, and sometimes people remain anonymous. Whatever you choose to do, that's okay. Deborah Honan from Spring Hill. Deborah, thanks a lot for that nice contribution. She just joined the Circle of Friends, and she says MNF is a treasure to all who seek the truth and compassion and social justice. She's been a listener for 20 years. And Robin in Sarasota just made a $60 contribution. Thank you, Robin. She's upping her Circle of Friends membership. Thanks to Anonymous in Tallahassee, Florida, a $20 contribution. And thanks to Anonymous in Tampa, a $10 contribution. Thank you, Anonymous. And John in Clearwater just made a $300 contribution via Circle of Friends, $25 a month. John, thank you very much for that nice contribution. Love everything we do for the people of the Tampa Bay area. So, Sean, that's a nice flurry of phone calls over the last hour and 15 minutes. And this is the last day of fundraising for WMNF, and we hope to raise that $73,000 by tonight. We've heard so far from about 22 people during the non-talking animal news and public affairs, and we need to hear from 38 more people this hour, and we're just about to hear the finish of Democracy Now!
So this is your last chance to donate to support Democracy Now! During this short two-day fund drive. So we know there are fans of Democracy Now! Out there. Maybe you haven't made a donation in a year or so, and you'd like to contribute. You'd like to up your membership or become a new member, we would love that. Can you call 813-238-8001? Tell us why Democracy Now! Is important to you or whatever your favorite show is. We'd love to read the comments on the air. Give us a call, 813-238-8001. You can make a donation on our secure website, WMNF.org. And if you have a smartphone, you can use the app to make a donation. But I do want to tell you, I was hearing from our phone answerers that people who have iPhones are having a harder time donating on the app right now. We're trying to get that fixed. But if you are on an iPhone, you might want to go to WMNF.org to make your donation this time.
So, Sean, let's pick up with Democracy Now! We're going to hear Varsha Prakash of the Sunrise Movement, the group that fights global warming, being asked a question about Joe Manchin, the senator from West Virginia, who's a Democrat. And Juan is asking the question whether or not he'll be helpful on the issue of climate change. Let's go back to today's Democracy Now! On 88.5 FM.
What do you think are the hopes for the movement to be able to pressure the Senate on these issues?
Yeah, I mean, we have to go for broke in this moment. I think now is the time to pressure Democrats and Republicans alike, also senators who are up for re-election in 2022. I think we need to be in the streets to the extent that that is safe and possible. We need to be making calls to these congresspeople. We need to be writing op-eds and letters to the editor. The only reason that Joe Biden is and Chuck Schumer are prioritizing climate in this moment is because the movement made them do so. And, you know, two or three years ago, the climate crisis and climate justice was thought of as a political loser. Nobody wanted to touch it with an 100-foot pole, and it was sort of like a shameful secret to tuck climate policy into the corners of various other policies. That isn't true anymore, and it's because we agitated and we organized and we bird-dogged these politicians every place that they were, and that I'm seeing a lot of people seeing in this moment attempting to make actually the same mistake that we made when Obama got into office of saying, we've got a Democrat back in, now we can sit back. And that is a huge danger. So we've got to keep up the pressure on people like Joe Manchin, Kyrsten Sinema, and a number of others. And, you know, in addition to that, I think it's time for Joe Biden to show that he, you know, to cash in on the relationships that he claims to have made over the last decades in office, and to bring the caucus fully along, because ultimately, if we can abolish the filibuster, we can pass a lot of policy with just a simple majority.
So the comparisons, Varshini, between how you all have been dealt with, these peaceful protests you've had at the Capitol, hundreds of you were arrested in 2018, mm-hmm. To what happened at the Capitol now. Interestingly, the first woman, first African-American chief of Capitol Police did admit She's now the head of it because the one who was there during the insurrection, Chief Zund, had to resign. They knew that this protest on January 6th would be nothing like what they'd seen in the past, mm-hmm. that people had guns, that they were white supremacists. They understood that they would be violent. And yet it's peaceful protesters like you who are the ones who've gotten arrested in the Capitol.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, it was just incredible to also be reminded of the uprisings from last summer and the images, just honest, frankly, traumatic images I saw of women being beat or groped in the streets or being arrested, or members of my own movement and organization who were trapped on bridges in New York, hundreds of people trapped on bridges and tear gassed. I'm not saying that people deserve that kind of treatment. I think what I'm saying is, there was clearly a double standard in this seriousness. And I think that what we've got to be prepared for as a movement is to understand that white supremacy, that nationalism, that rising fascism, that hate and division existed long, long before Donald Trump and will continue to exist after Donald Trump. We cannot make the mistake of believing that white supremacy is bookended by the Trump administration. And I'm seeing a lot of people with that sort of false hope. And so I think as we know, we've just come off of Martin Luther King Day. The only thing that can contest with rising escalated violence is rising escalated peaceful, loving nonviolence and community action. And so I think we've got to join with our movements, the Movement for Black Lives, immigrant justice movements, movements against gun violence, et cetera, alongside the climate movement to put a stop to it.
We just have 30 seconds, but Biden has issued an executive order against the Keystone XL pipeline, but not against the Dakota Access Pipeline. It was one of those epic struggles that took place to shut it down, led by the Standing Rock Sioux. They are demanding that it be shut down now. Your thoughts?
I mean, he has to. He absolutely has to. And there's precedent for doing so. Obama stopped it. And I mean, it was an unparalleled global indigenous resistance. The water protectors, I mean, it was one of the most incredible, inspiring things that I have ever seen in my life. And I'd also put in that category pipelines like the Line 3 pipeline, which has been facing enormous indigenous and rural resistance in Minnesota.
Varshini Prakashi, thank you so much for being with us, co-founder, executive director of the Sunrise Movement. When we come back, where have all the vaccines gone? Stay with us.
And we're going to hear all about it in just a moment, right here on WMNF in Tampa. Well, this is the last day of fundraising for News and Public Affairs, the last day of fundraising for the whole station, and we won't be doing this again until March, and we'll do a two-day drive in March. So we hope that you'll make a contribution today. Donations power this radio station and keep us on the air. And we couldn't do it without you. We couldn't do it without the great people who listen. Thanks to Jim Bannon in Lakeland, just made a $100 contribution. He is a big fan of the stations. Thank you, Jim, for that nice contribution. We're about 37 calls away from reaching the goal for this hour. Please call us at 813-238-8001.
January has become the deadliest month of the pandemic so far, with at least 80,000 deaths in the United States, and the month is not over. The United States has about a fifth of the deaths and infections in the world. On Tuesday, President Biden announced plans to acquire another 200 million doses of COVID-19 vaccines with a goal of vaccinating most people in the country by summer. But the Biden White House is facing a crisis after the Trump administration left no plan for distributing vaccines. In addition, millions of vaccine dosages have apparently gone missing. The Daily Beast reports about 41 million doses have been handed out to states, but less than 22 million have been administered. This is based on data from the Centers for Disease Control. Meanwhile, many states report running out of vaccines. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki addressed the issue Tuesday.
Our team is working right now. We've been here for 5 days to evaluate the supply so that we can release the maximum amount while also ensuring that everyone can get the second dose on the FDA recommended schedule. So the confusion around this issue, which we acknowledge there is some confusion, is speaks to a larger problem, which is what we're inheriting from the prior administration, which is much worse than we could have imagined. So we are assessing now what we have access to and ensuring that we have more of a rapid engagement with states so that they have more of a heads up on what to expect in the weeks ahead.
We're joined now by Daily Beast reporter Erin Banco. Her latest piece is headlined, Millions of Vaccine Doses Are MIA and Feds Aren't Sure Why. Erin, this is an astounding story. It's not that the U.S. doesn't have enough vaccines. We're talking about 20 million vaccines. You have in New York City the canceling of appointments by various hospitals and other places because they just don't have the vaccines, and that's just one city in this country. Where have all the vaccines gone?
Hi there. Thanks for having me. Yeah, this is an incredible moment that we're in right now. The Biden team has been working really overtime over the last several days to try to figure out why states are reporting shortages while also reporting that their vaccination rates are quite low. So the CDC's federal tracker, vaccine tracker, says that about 40 million doses of the COVID-19 vaccine have been distributed to states, but as you pointed out, only about 20 million of those doses have been administered. That's a huge gap. Now, some of that gap might be attributed to states holding second dose reserves, doses that are being allocated or earmarked for the federal long-term care facility vaccination program. But apart from those sort of anecdotes of reserve holding and the long-term care facility program, states are telling federal officials that they believe millions of doses are sort of lost in the distribution system, whether they be in warehouses or refrigerators at main distribution hubs. And so what the Biden team is trying to do now is sort of do an accounting exercise to figure out where these vaccine doses are located, whether they're still good, whether they're expired, or whether they can be put in people's arms, and how to get them to where they need to be going. Now, states are saying we have shortages. I talked to a couple of state officials over the past few days who say the demand for the vaccine spiked in recent weeks. They've scheduled, you know, tens of thousands of appointments, and they just simply do not have enough supply to fill that demand. But the federal government's problem is, well, you still have vaccine doses out there, according to our data. So where are these doses?
And Erin, what about the potential for an already existing black market? Because I've become increasingly convinced that this is going to become one of the biggest scandals of this entire pandemic, is the distribution of these vaccines, because clearly, there is a market for these vaccines out there, and people who are wealthy enough or who are have the connections can potentially feed a black market in them. Are there any indications that that's already been happened? There's clearly indications that with those who have received the vaccines, because I know of personal examples of people who have exaggerated their underlying conditions in order to get into the front of the line, situations of abusing the essential worker designation in order to get to the front of the line. But of the missing vaccines, do you see any indications of siphoning off of supplies illegally?
I do not have any anecdotal or concrete evidence that these vaccines are being, quote unquote, stolen, or that there's a black market that exists. But I think you're right. I think we've been hearing, you know, I personally have been hearing a lot of stories about residents in New York who are calling into Jersey City vaccination centers, you know, saying inflating their comorbidity status and getting in across state lines to get vaccines. Other, you know, instances out west where wealthy hospital donors are jumping the line to get the vaccine. But I think what all of this tells us is that a couple of weeks ago, the Trump administration, in line with the Biden team, transition team, decided to widen the pool of who could qualify to get this vaccine. part of the fear internally within the Trump administration was that the vaccine rates were super low and they were afraid of the slow uptake. So as a way to remedy that, they decided to widen the pool of who could sign up and get the vaccine. Now, that almost sort of worked too well, because we're at a point now where demand is super high in a lot of states. And states simply just don't have the infrastructure, the staff, or the ability to administer those doses quickly. And they're also saying we have shortages. So I think the black market issue is less apparent right now. I think what's really happening on a state level is basic accounting problems for where these vaccines have gone, why the question is why can't we get these into people's arms more quickly? It's a supply chain issue, and there are sort of different problems at every step of the supply chain, and those problems look different from state to state. So for the federal government, the question is, how do we get our hands around this problem, and how do we come up with a national plan that encapsulates all these different anecdotal issues that we're hearing about across the country?
And what about this tracking system that the federal government has? I mean, in a world where Google knows exactly where every individual is based on their smartphone and their GPS, what is the tracking system that the federal government is using? Is it relying on the states once the doses are delivered to let them know what's happened, or is it continuing to track the vaccine shipments?
I think this is one of the biggest stories right now, and sort of an underreported issue, is the lack of concrete, reliable, comprehensive data at the federal government level. So the way that the federal government tracks the vaccine distribution, they rely on a slew of different streams of data, including state
Aaron,
data.
Aaron, we have 20 seconds.
Data from Tiberius, which is the Pentagon tracking system. But there are lags in reporting, and the data that they're looking at is just not reliable enough to understand what the issue is. And so that's what they're working on now. How do we get better data so we can diagnose the issue?
Aaron Vanko, I want to thank you so much for being with us, and we will link to your piece, Millions of Vaccine Doses Are MIA, Feds Aren't Sure Why. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Wear a mask.
Thanks to Amy Goodman, too, for that good questioning of Aaron. And, you know, what stands out to me, Sean, about that interview is how careful the reporter from the Daily Beast was, and how, you know, lots of times when you hear, especially if you go on AM talk radio or if you go to Fox News, there's name calling and there's an attitude and there's like, oh, only I have the answer. And there is careful questioning on a really important issue. It's in all the newspapers today. It's in the Tampa Bay Times. And it's very important to know that, you know, there's nuance, and you can't always name call, and you can't always point fingers. There's a question. Where did all these vaccines go? We don't know yet. It's an important question. It should be followed. But usually when you turn on AM talk radio, they'll have an easy answer for you. Oh, so-and-so stole it, or so-and-so, you know.
George Soros.
George Soros, right. There's no easy answer here, but it's an important question. And you can bet that here on WMNF and also on Democracy Now!, we'll continue to follow the question, and we'll get closer and closer to the truth. And finally, we'll get to the truth. But that's the way it is here at WMNF. Careful, careful reporting. So please support the radio station that brings you Democracy Now! Every day. This is the last day of our fund drive, the last chance that we'll have to ask you to support us. We won't be fundraising for February. And when we get to March, we'll just do another short two-day fund drive. Mm-hmm. So these fund drives are really important. Today, we need to hear from about 37 more people, and we'll be there actually now 34 more people, because Marley Lopez from Tampa just made a contribution. Thank you, Marley. Joined the Circle of Friends at $5 a month, and she's a 16-year-old listener. I hope more teens tune in and contribute to WMNF. Me and my sister love Amy Goodman. Thank you for all you do. Marley, thank you. I can't tell you how important that is to hear from you, Marley. That's really, you're the next generation of MNF listeners. Marley, thanks a lot.
Thank
from
you, Marley.
Tampa. And thanks to Anonymous, who just made a nice contribution from Brandon, $20, and Anonymous also also from Tampa, made a donation of $10 a month to our sustaining membership that we call Circle of Friends. Well, Sean, we're going to hear a really great interview coming up next with a guy who represents a group, Life After Hate, a nonprofit whose mission is to rehabilitate individuals who have lived a life of hate in groups like the KKK and the neo-Nazis and anti-Semitic groups. And it's a group formed by ex-members of these groups to try to show people there's another path. And we're going to talk first about the January 6th insurrection, what they saw, how they observed it. And then we're going to hear this interview next that I did yesterday with Dimitri Kalantzis, who represents the group Life After Hate. He's the director of communications of that group. And hopefully, as people listen to this interview, you'll make a contribution. This is the last chance I'll ask during Radioactivity, even though we just started the program. And here's another donation that just came in. This is very nice. Kevin Marshall from Venice, Florida, is making a one-time pledge. Just turned 72. He's been listening since the 1980s. MNF is part of his DNA, and Kevin has just donated $1,000 to WMNF.
Thank you, Kevin.
Kevin, thank you. That is huge. That gets us much, much, much closer to our goal. And I think we'll need to hear from about 30 people now to reach that goal today. So please call us at 813-238-8001.
When you call that number, you'll hear great phone answers that are volunteers, and they're being sustained by great members in the community who are donating food. For example, Sunday's Delicatessen, which is located at 1930 East 7th Avenue in Tampa's Ybor City, prepared lunch for the volunteers and staff today. So thanks for feeding us again, David. We're happy to have your continued support of our community and WMNF Radio. So our phone answerers are getting their volunteers, and they're getting food from our community members, and they would like to hear from you as well, to hear your donations by calling 813-238-8001, or if you prefer, you can donate on our secure website, which is WMNF.org.
All right, so if you like the interviews you hear every day on Radioactivity, which is the show at 11 a.m. here on WMNF, we hope you make a contribution now. Here is my interview with Dimitri Kalantzis of the group Life After Hate. Dimitri, welcome to WMNF. Thank you for coming on the program.
Thanks for having me.
So, first of all, let's talk about the insurrection at the Capitol on January 6th. As a group that looks at hate groups, did you see anything as you were watching the coverage, or in the days after seeing the pictures that were coming out of the Capitol, did you see anything that concerned you or alarmed you?
Yes. This event was an act of domestic terrorism intended to intimidate the U.S. people and their government. It's important to note that there is a federal definition of domestic terrorism. There is no specific law. But more concerning from our vantage point is the idea that grievances, and this is important to note, real and perceived, can quickly escalate to violence. And more to the point, grievances will be exploited to radicalize others to violence.
And what kind of grievances do you think were used by the organizers of this attempt to take over the Capitol?
I mean, that's the complicated question. And we need to be careful here. We need to be careful here that we aren't coming off as an organization that works with people who are thinking about leaving hate groups or leaving hateful ideology behind. We don't condemn the individual, we condemn the ideology. And part of the process begins with listening to people's grievances. And I use the words real and perceived for a reason. And just because someone has a grievance, even if it's a legitimate grievance, right, does not condone at all and never does any type of violence or intimidation, right? There should be consequences. There should be, if someone committed a crime, they should be held accountable for that. So I want to make that clear. But what you see on January 6th is the culmination of years of radicalization, people being told a number of things, that their way of life is being threatened, that their communities are under threat. There is certainly a significance, right? Last year when we saw communities protesting racism, systemic racism, that was used by the violent far right to recruit and to radicalize people. We often say that this was populism on steroids, and these trends that we've been seeing for the last 10 years, even. I mean, you can go back to the midterm elections during the Barack Obama first administration. But to be very clear, it's mostly xenophobia and racism masquerading as anti-elitism. Mm.
So what were the symbols that you saw that were carried by these groups that tried to take over the Capitol? What kind of symbols did you see? What was the range of far-right groups that were represented that you noticed?
Yeah, so here's one of those questions, Rob, that I'm only deferring on this because a number of other organizations have done some really great work on this for years, and most recently since January 6th. And it's not in my wheelhouse. Symbolism is not in my wheelhouse. I know that there was a lot of bastardized Christian imagery reminiscent of the Crusades. I know we saw a Confederate flag flying in the U.S. Capitol. I think that says it. That says it all. We saw symbolism that was that harkened back to the Nazis.
Okay, so I mean, we did see Pepe the Frog is a symbol of the far right. Mm-hmm. It's a neo-Nazi symbol. There was a green flag, kind of celebrating that belief. There was the anti-Holocaust or a T-shirt making fun of the Holocaust. You mentioned the Confederate flag. They were all there. I just wondered, among the members of Life After Hate, did that raise alarms when the members of your group saw this unfolding in the Capitol?
Yeah, that's a good question. Organizations like ours are not surprised by what happened. I think the real impact here is on the public's perception. And we saw something similar play out after the deadly Unite the Right rally at Charlottesville in 2017. It was a moment of reckoning for a nation that for a long time either didn't take the violent far right seriously or didn't know that it was as far reaching as it is.
Mm-hmm. So your group, Life After Hate, your mission is to rehabilitate individuals who have lived a life of hate and point them down mm-hmm. to a better path. So you've got a lot of people who are ex-members of far-right hate groups. So what's driven membership in these far-right groups? I mean, your members know it intimately because they were once over on that side of the political spectrum. What's driven the membership, and is the membership of these far-right groups on the rise?
I think a lot of organizations would say, yeah, there is an increase in people that are at least sympathetic to the ideology. You brought up social media earlier, and you can't tell this story without talking about social media. Violent extremism is a game of small percentages. Recruiters will cast as wide a net as possible to reach even one person. The internet makes that so much more effective. So being able to target people who are vulnerable or at risk for this type of ideology is key. And being able to reach people on the mainstream platforms like Facebook and Twitter, and now some of the more offbeat platforms, including Parler, you've heard this now, talked about more and more in the last 2 weeks, is a really important development. So if there is a game changer, it's the means of communications, for sure, and people being able to reach millions of people with the stroke of a key.
Our guest is Dimitri Kalantzis. He's a spokesperson for a group called Life After Hate. It's a nonprofit whose mission is to rehab individuals who have lived a life of hate. And you're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. it's funny that, you know, you're talking about Facebook and Twitter, and here you've got people who are on the right wing of the political spectrum complaining that they've been, their free speech has been denied by these corporations. It's interesting that they're making that complaint, yet a couple of the means of expanding far-right membership is Facebook and Twitter.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think a lot of the First Amendment arguments are sort of obfuscating. The issue here isn't, well, there's a number of issues when it comes to the First Amendment argument, but certainly people aren't arguing that certain groups shouldn't have the right to free speech. What people are suggesting is that you don't have the right to incite people to violence against others. That's a crime, right? And it's always been a crime, right? And then the other argument, and this isn't something that as an organization we delve into, but you know, it's certainly a big part of the narrative here. The reach, the ability to reach as many people as one can on these platforms is really one of the nuances of this story that we still don't fully understand, right? It's only been about 10 years that we've had social media, and we are just now beginning to understand that algorithms that are not completely transparent or not transparent at all to the public have a way of driving people to the fringes of their ideology, whether it's far right or far left, right? Mm. That much we know is true, and that is a dangerous game.
So, Dimitri, tell our audience a little bit about the history of Life After Hate and a little bit more about the purpose of your organization. How did your organization come about?
Certainly. Back in 10 years ago, actually, we're coming up on our 10-year anniversary, a group of formers met at a conference in Dublin, and they didn't know what they were on the verge of doing. All they knew is that they had exited violent extremism on their own, and they knew it was their responsibility to make sure that no one else had to do that on their own again. And so they started off by launching an online magazine so that they can share their stories. And eventually this grew into a nonprofit that is committed to helping people leave the violent far right. And our vision is a world that allows people to change and contribute to a society without violence. And I say that because a big part of that vision and a big part of our mission is helping shape a society that's willing to accept these men and women back and is willing to allow these individuals to redeem themselves.
I'm curious how the members decided that they had gone too far. And I'm guessing it's groups like the Nazis or the Klan or other groups that subscribe to hate. I wonder if you could tell us a story about one group member and how they arrived at the conclusion that they were on the wrong track.
Yeah, that's a great question. Understanding why people leave hate groups or begin questioning the ideology is important. And I can tell you two of our founding members were inspired to begin thinking about changing. Back in 1995, the Oklahoma City bombing. Many of your listeners probably remember one of the most impactful photos that came out of that day was a fireman holding a toddler in his arms. And that moment inspired two of our founders to change. And interestingly enough, now, you know, 25 years later, we know, and the research supports this, that violence, particularly against vulnerable populations, has a way of making people, individuals in hate groups, feel as though they have gone too far. That is the line for some of these individuals. Other individuals become disillusioned with the so-called movement when they feel that their group is not, is straying from what they thought initially was political activism. Those are just two factors that we've seen over the years.
Mm. I asked this question earlier, but let me ask it again. Do you think these groups are on the rise? Do you think that the far right is growing both domestically in the U.S. and around the world?
Yes. Unfortunately, yes. And we talked about social media. We talked about the politics that's fueling this, how polarizing the political milieu is at the moment. There's other research that looks into extreme wealth inequality and how that is oftentimes a prerequisite for extreme ideologies to take hold, particularly with far-right politicians. And we've seen this in the last several years worldwide. So until we begin to address some of the systemic issues that people are facing here and abroad, you're always going to have ripe conditions for people to be sort of seduced by hateful ideology.
You know, I'm wondering what your thoughts are. Sometimes, for instance, the Occupy Wall Street movement of a little bit more than a decade ago was a movement organized against the excesses, the excess profits, and the vast sums of money being made on Wall Street, and saying, "Hey, folks on the low and moderate income level are hurting." But they didn't engage in hate. They did occupy a park in New York. But what makes somebody decide, okay, I'm going to hate other people because of their skin color or because of their religion? What makes them go in that direction if they're angry at wealth inequality?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I think immigration is and has always been a very, very polarizing issue everywhere, here and abroad. And it's a scapegoat. It's a scapegoat issue. It's really, sometimes it's that simple. And when people are faced with a lot of these systemic issues, you often see immigration being pointed out as a part of that this is the cause of your problem, right? You see this especially in Europe with migrant workers coming over the border into Western Europe. And it seems to be a very convenient way of assaging people's anxieties there. And I think you see the same thing happening here in the States.
Well, we're talking about the group Life After Hate with a spokesperson. He is Dimitri Kalantzis, and this is WMNF in Tampa. And Dimitri, you talked earlier about how the hate ideology is spread through social media. You have a project that Life After Hate is involved in called We Counter Hate that tackles the problem of social media. What does it do?
So We Counter Hate was a countering campaign on Twitter. It was launched in 2018. And what it did was it used artificial intelligence to tag and track tweets that used dehumanizing language to attack people. And it turned that hate tweet on its head and essentially turned it into a fundraising tactic for the organization. And it told people that, right? It said, it warned the user, the tweeter, that this particular tweet had been flagged and that it would, every time it was retweeted or shared, it would essentially donate money to Life After Hate. And what we found, we call that countering the tweet, and what we found that 16% of the tweets that were countered were ultimately deleted by the user. More than a third of the offending accounts were suspended after a tweet was countered, and ultimately 20 million fewer people were exposed to hate speech on Twitter. And so that's the amazing story of We Counter Hate. It sunset a year ago, and mostly because of changes to the actual platform. Twitter is one of the more open platforms on social media, and there were certain changes made that sort of essentially rendered We Counter Hate ineffective. But yeah, in the years that it ran, in the 2 years that it ran, it did a lot of great work, and we're really proud of that. And I have to say it, we launched that with a creative agency Possible in Seattle, and they did amazing work here. And it was ultimately an award-winning campaign.
Well, that was an interview I did yesterday. There's more to it, and we'll see if we can get to it. An upcoming question is, how do you de-radicalize people who are on the far right? My guest, Demetrius Kalantzis, and Dimitri is a spokesperson for the nonprofit group Life After Hate, a nonprofit whose mission is to rehabilitate individuals who have lived a life of hate. The group was founded by ex-members of groups like the KKK and the neo-Nazis here in the U.S., and he actually describes the founding of the group, too. It is an international group. Well, you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. We're fundraising here. Sean Cannan is here. I'm Rob Lori. We're going to try to raise some money, and this is typical of the kind of interview that you hear every day on Radioactivity. And if you appreciate the interviews that we do with people that you might not hear on any other media, or if you do, you don't hear them very often, please call us up and keep this program on the air and keep this radio station on the air by calling 813-238-8001. Yesterday, we came up a little bit short on public affairs. Today, we're a little bit short, but we can make it. Mm-hmm. if we get a lot of donations, especially right now. We'd like to get about 30 more donations this hour, and we have about 8 minutes to go. Kay Garcia from Brooksville has made a donation of $26. Thank you, Kay, and says, we're so lucky to have this radio station in Tampa Bay. And Patrick Dunnigan from Bloomington, Indiana, has made a $50 contribution. Beautiful Brown County up there. Patrick, thanks a lot. And he says, cheap psychotherapy. That's what he calls WMNF. Nice. So, Sean, if we could hear from 30 more people this hour, we'd be on track. Nola will be along in the next hour. I don't know if we're going to be able to play the end of this interview, but please call us up if you enjoy listening to the thoughtful programs that you hear here on WMNF. Help us reach that goal right now by calling 813-238-8001. And make a contribution in any amount you can afford.
Important interviews like this on the most topical issues of the day, that's what you get on WMNF, and that's especially what you get here in the 11 o'clock hour Radioactivity on weekday mornings. So if you want to support that, if you think that that's valuable and that it's good that your neighbors can turn on their radios and hear something like this, and that you can as well, and that you can share this with people far and wide, please support it. Help keep it on the air by calling 813-238-8001 or donating at WMNF.org. Can you join the Circle of Friends at $10 a month in honor of the great interviews that Rob does every morning? 813-238-8001. Anonymous in Tampa says that they're riding with 46 and are donating $46 to WMNF. So thank you for that contribution. Now it's your turn. 813-238-8001.
Yeah, we had a $1,000 donation earlier. It'd be great to get one more $1,000 contribution from one good person, maybe living in Sun City Center, maybe living in Lakeland, or maybe living in Brooksville or Dade City or Lake Alfred or Winter Haven or Venice or Sarasota or Palm Harbor or Seminole or Largo or Clearwater or Treasure Island. 813-238-8001. If you're out there and you haven't yet contributed and you're a new listener and you're thinking, wow, what a great radio station this is, we hope you make that contribution. And maybe you've been listening for years and thought, wow, I really should donate. I'm feeling a little bit sad I don't donate. Today would be a good day because you would help us reach our goal, which is, I think, $14,000 on news and public affairs. Sean, let's see if we play some more of this interview. We're not getting the kind of calls we hope to get, but please call us up at 813-238-8001. Here's more of my interview with Dimitri Kalantzis, who is with a nonprofit group called Life After Hate.
I'm very proud of that.
So, Dimitri, can people who have adopted a Nazi or Klan or some other far-right ideology that hates people who are immigrants or people of color or people because of their religion, can they be de-radicalized? And if your group has experience doing that, how do they do it?
Absolutely. Change is always possible. And we believe In fact, this is the bedrock of our organization, that anyone willing to take responsibility for their past deserves a chance to redeem themselves. How you begin helping people de-radicalize is complicated. It's just as complicated as how people get drawn in the first place. But what we know is that people often join these hate groups for reasons other than belief in a hateful ideology, right? And so these other factors, including childhood trauma, abuse, shame, alienation, people wanting to find a community or status or a sense of identity, if those are some of the factors that got people in, addressing those will help them get out.
Have you been successful? Have many people come to you to leave the organization, or have friends or family members referred them to your organization, and that you've been successful in getting people turned away from hate groups?
I mean, absolutely. We've helped hundreds of people in the last several years, and a number of those of that client base increasingly is comprised of family and friends. I mean, we have to be careful here, right, that there isn't an on-off switch. Radicalization is a nonlinear process that makes de-radicalization a nonlinear process. There is no beginning, middle, end. And in fact, I am reminded by one of the founding members who talks about this work exiting as a lifelong process. And there is other research that has drawn comparisons between exiting and drug addiction, and inside both there being the capacity for relapses. So there are no quick fixes, and but what we do works, and we know it works, and it just takes a tremendous amount of time and commitment.
So it sounds like, and you mentioned drugs, it sounds like Alcoholics Anonymous.
Mm. There are a number of people who have studied this and have made that comparison. So you're not off on.
Well, that's my part of my interview with Mitri Kalantzis with the group Life After Hate. It's a nonprofit which was founded by ex-members of hate groups, and its mission is to rehabilitate individuals who have lived a life of hate. And you can find them at lifeafterhate.org. Well, if you appreciate WMNF and all the programs we have here on WMNF, we hope you make that contribution today. Thanks to Brian Wilson and Teresa Hardy. They did make a contribution of $10 a month. Thank you, Brian and Therese. And they say, keep up the good work. Truth matters. Please call us at 813-238-8001 and make that contribution. You can also make your contribution on our secure website, WMNF.org.
Support the work that goes on right here. We have a building that we have to keep up. We have electricity bills, antenna bills, tower bills, and we have a small staff, but we need your help to keep everything running smoothly. 813-238-8001 or WMNF.org is how you can support great interviews like the one that you have been hearing from Rob about hate groups and how people can overcome that. If that's something that is worth supporting, give us a call. Maybe make a $100 donation, or maybe join the Circle of Friends at $10 a month or $5 a month. 813-238-8001.
And we could still use a $1,000 contribution. Of course, every donation is greatly appreciated. $10 is appreciated, $25, $50, $75, $80, $100, $500, whatever you can afford. We're probably still, during this hour, probably 25 calls short of reaching the goal. We have about a minute to go. Please make that call at 813-238-8001. If you appreciate the one radio station that brings you thoughtful local and national and international guests, this is it. here at WMNF, and please keep it on the air. Your donation is essential. 70% of our money comes from donations from listeners. We have small matching grants from the state and the federal government, but they only give us money based on what we can raise locally, and it's not a one-to-one match. So most of our money, 70% of our money, comes from the great listeners that we have. And if you appreciate this unique radio station that you're not going to find in Jacksonville or Orlando, please call us today at 813-238-8001. This is we're entering the last hour of fundraising for public affairs, and we'll go back to music at 1 o'clock. We have great music here. So please help us out by going to WMNF.org. This is WMNF in Tampa, and stay tuned for NOLA's